Mr. Fletcher, first of all, I want to thank you for agreeing to be interviewed for our Living Oral History Project.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with some demographics and family history.
Okay.
So I'm first going to ask you some simple demographic questions, and these questions may jog your memory, but please keep your answers brief and to the point for now. We can go into more detail later in the interview.
Okay.
Please say and spell your name.
Robert Warren Fletcher, R-O-V-E-R-T, capital W-A-R-R-E-N, F-L-E-T-C-H-E-R.
What is your date of birth, including the year?
12/2/32.
How would you describe your ethnic background?
Mixture. My mother was Cherokee Indian and French Canadian, and my father was Mohawk Indian and African American.
What is your religion, if any?
Protestant.
What is the highest level of formal education you have completed?
2 years at community college.
Did you attend any additional school or formal career training beyond that?
No.
What is your marital status?
Married.
Okay. How many children do you have?
4 living.
Okay.
We had 5 totally, 4 living.
All right. What was your primary occupation?
Well, I worked about almost 15 years for the Veterans Administration. I left there and went to work for Sears and Roebuck for 7 years. And then for 12 years, I was in the business for myself. And then I had a heart attack, and then I went to work for the city of Ann Arbor and retired from there.
Okay. And so when were you in the service?
I went into service on May 1, 1950.
Okay. Now we're going to move into part 2, Memories of Childhood and Youth.
Mm-hmm.
This part of the interview is about your childhood and youth. Even if these questions jog memories about other times in your life, once again, we're going to focus just on this area for now. What was your family like when you were a child?
Very loving and very caring.
How large was your family? How many in your family?
7.
Okay.
3 boys and 4 girls.
All right. Almost an even match there.
Almost, didn't you?
What sort of work did your parents do?
My father worked at the Ford plant in Dearborn, and my mother was a homemaker.
Okay. What are some of your earliest memories as a child?
Earliest memories? The loving care my mother gave to us and the family gave to all of us. My sisters and my brothers, they always were looking out for each other. And that is the most fondest memories I have. I did the same thing with my children. I taught them to look out for each other, not as a family, not as individuals.
That's really important.
Oh, it's very important in life to me.
Yeah, I would agree. Were there any special days or events or family traditions you remember from your childhood?
Well, every day was special.
Yeah. I like that.
Every day was. I'd come home from school and mother would be baking bread, and she always had a little bitty pan about that high. She'd put some bread in that for me, and I'd come in the house and, oh, it smells good. And she would say, well, we got to wait till it cools down. Oh, but Mom, she says, nope, got to wait. And then she'd pull it out, slice it, and put homemade butter in it and say, here, that was...
That sounds wonderful.
And it was good.
What holidays did your family celebrate?
They celebrated just about all of them. Christmas, Memorial Day, 4th of July. Well, back then, it was the 1st of May. They called it May Day then, and my worker's day, in other words. And so my family celebrated all the holidays.
Okay. Was there any that your family created that, other than the traditional holidays?
No, not that I know of.
Okay. How did you do birthdays celebrations?
Oh, birthdays were individually celebrated, not as a group like they do today. We were poor, and so your parents couldn't afford to buy anything for you. So mother would bake a cake and put a candle on it, or 10, or how old you were, and everybody, you know, you'd blow the candles out, you cut up the cake and sing Merry Christmas, and or Happy Birthday, I'm sorry. But that was pretty much it.
All right. I'm going to go back to school for a second here.
Yeah.
Did you play any sports or join any other activities outside of school?
In school, I played sports. I played basketball, and I played football, and I also ran track, and I excelled quite well.
What do you call it, a triple threat?
Yeah.
What about your school experience is different from school as you know it today?
As I know school today, the teachers had more disciplinary control of the classroom, which I feel is great. I felt was great for us. I feel without the teachers being able to take their class into control, it loses. The kids lose. And their parents don't come in. I told all teachers when I had my children, if they do something today, call me today. I will be here. And I would go. And I would talk to them. And I would tell them, now, if I have to come here again, you're not going to like it. Your class will laugh at you. I said, so don't make me come again. That usually all it took.
So in terms of educational opportunities, I want to ask you about what you saw then when you were growing up and now for specifically for minority students.
Well, when I grew up, there was a very narrow area for minority students. You went into the teaching field. You never saw bankers. You never saw lawyers. You never saw any of the professional in the sense of the word, black people.
Mm-hmm.
They were teachers and preachers and people of this category. Today, you are seeing more and more lawyers, teachers, the President of the United States, which I thought I would never live to see. You're seeing more and more African Americans getting into the broad brim of the field. Which I feel is great. We needed this a long time ago.
So that what you talked about then and now. And so what work is still left to be done, do you feel, in terms of in the educational arena for minorities?
I think we need to, and I don't know the answer to that, because what is happening, we have too many African-American kids dropping out of school. And they ended up in prison. And that's not good. We need them to be educated, because this is a wonderful functioning world they're living in. But you got to have the education. If you don't have it, you're left behind. And that's the biggest problem I see. I don't know what the dropout rate was when I went to school. It was very, very narrow. And today it is just too much. And I was talking with the wife, and I told my kids, you don't have to go to school, but you'll never accomplish anything. I don't care what you say. As they grew up, we took them to the poor areas, we took them to the middle class areas, we took them to the rich areas, and then I'd say, which one would you like to live? And they'd say, oh, that one there. I'd say, why? Oh, they got nice homes and cars. I said, but how do you think they got them? Money. I said, no, come better than that. Education. And you won't do it without it. I'm a very lucky man to say that all my kids graduated from high school. I have three daughters that graduated from college.
That's wonderful.
I have one son who graduated from community college as a licensed mechanic. He did not want to go to college. I mean, we tried to talk him in, and he said, no, I just want my mechanical license. So out of the five kids, the other son of mine, he got his degree in medical. His mother's a nurse, and so he got it in managing doctor's offices. And so he's doing quite well for himself. So that's the main thing I see, is that my wife and I were involved highly with our kids in school. If she wasn't there, I was there. If she wasn't there, we both were there. This is the way it worked. I'd come in from work and come like I never changed. Yeah, you know, I didn't have enough time for plays and things, and oh, I'd just rave how good they were, you know. And I always said, there's nothing in this world you can't do, but you got to get an education to do it.
And parent involvement is really key as well.
I feel it is the key. It is the most important role, all from kindergarten through high school. Just can't go through grade school and stop. You got to go all the way with them.
So in terms of going back to your growing up and your family when you were a child and growing up, were there any special sayings or expressions during this time that you can remember?
You know, I thought about that. And I really couldn't come up with one. I couldn't think of one. I tried my darndest, but when we were young and we got through eating, we ate first, then we left, then the adults ate, and they were in there talking, and you better not be listening. You got out of the house. So I don't know. I really don't know.
What about a Bible scripture or anything along those lines?
No, my mother was a great person for the Bible, and so she had a different one every time. I'm not a scholar of the Bible, okay. I'll be honest with you.
Okay. And
the only one I know is the 23rd Psalms.
That's a good one to know.
And we'll probably get to that.
Yeah, okay. So were there any changes in your family life during your school years?
Yeah, my father died in 1942. My father died. He died in the summer of 42, and I really never got to know my father. I was just starting to know him. And I was just starting to maybe, as it goes, get interested in the family and ask the questions. And this was really devastating to me because my father and I had started doing things together. And when he died, I asked my mother, I said, when will he be back? And she said, no, he won't be back. And I said, why not? And my mother was always a person that had patience. She always had patience, and she explained it to me, and I still couldn't accept that as a child. And it took me a long, long time to accept it. And mother remarried about a year later, and my stepfather told me to do something, and I looked at him, I told him, you're not my father, you don't tell me what to do. And mother said, what did you say? I said, mother, I told him, he's not my father. He don't tell me what to do. And I was never afraid to talk to my mother. Even though I might get punished, I was not afraid to talk to her. And I would tell her the truth. And she said, you get out there and get it done, then you come on in here and sit down. And I did, and she said, why would you do that? I said, because he's not my father. My father's dead, and I'll never accept anybody else. But he's feeding you, mother, I said, when I get to be 17, I'm leaving here. And I said, I'm not joking. She said, no, you need to stay in school. I said, no. But that was the difference.
Okay, that was a big difference.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions, a group of questions here. When thinking back on your school years, what important social or historical events were taking place at the time, and how did they personally affect you and your family?
I think the largest, the best, oh, let me get it recorded.
Right.
probably the best social event was the legislation in the state that killed all discrimination in buying of homes, restaurants. Michigan always pretty much had that law and opened the door for other entrepreneurs, especially African Americans, to go into areas where they never could go before and open businesses. And what was the other part of that?
It was just what social historical events were taking place at the time and how did they personally affect you and your family?
I'd say the social event would be integration, total integration in the state of Michigan, and the opening up of selling homes and buying homes. Because they had a tendency to, realtors spear you. Well, your people live over here. And I said, whose people? Who are you talking about? I said, you made a statement, clarify it. I didn't mean anything. I said, yes, you did mean something by it, or you wouldn't have said it. I said, leave. And I called another realtor. But that's me, and a lot of people wouldn't have probably done that, but I've never bit my tongue.
Okay, I'm going to continue along that line of question. You lived during the era of segregation. Can you speak about that? Was your school segregated? Was the elementary school near your home? Was there a high school for black students in the same area?
Okay, first one. I lived during the time of segregation, but Ypsilanti was a very small town before the bomber plant opened. And I really grew up not seeing or feeling segregation. I could go into any store and they just about knew the family from my dad. And they'd wait on me and everything else and it never bothered me. Then the bomber plant opened and then, and I'm not just saying Southern people, that's where people make a big mistake. All poor people moved in. And they started hiring them at the stores. And one time I went into Kresge's and I needed to buy a pencil. And the lady would walk away from me every time I'd go to approach. And that time the manager was up on the top and he could see the whole store. And I went up and I said, why won't she sell me this pencil? And he said, you go back down there. So I went back down and she'd move over and he came down after about her third try and says, you, go home. And I never saw her in the store again after that. And he apologized and gave me the pencil and I said, no, I got 3 pennies. And he said, no, it's yours to keep. He said, because people shouldn't treat you like that. And so I never really grew up with segregation until the bomber plant people moved in. And then you start hearing the N-word, which I'd never heard. And I went home and I had to ask my mother, what are they talking about? And she said, son, I could tell you something that would make you bitter for the rest of your life. But life's too short to go around being angry at people. She said, they don't know what they're talking about. Just let it go. Okay, fine. Then when I went to the service is where I really ran into segregation. I went down to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I was the only African-American in a group of about 12 from Michigan. And we went in a restaurant at the train station and sat down. And the waitress, boy, she was having a hard time. Finally, one of the guys said, hey, we want to get waited on. And she said, just a minute. She went and got the manager. He came over and he says, well, we can't serve him in here. And we all said, who? And he said, colored people have to go around the back. I said, oh, no, I don't go around nobody's back door. I don't even go around my own back door. So I said, I'm going. And we all walked out. And after I went to Fort Knox, it was very segregated. I didn't realize it. They all went this way and I went that way. And I've never seen them since. And the military at the time was very segregated. I went to 367 Field Artillery as a field artillery gunner And then I was transferred to the 761st Tank Battalion as an infantryman. And that's where we took our basic training there and ended up going to Japan.
Okay, so I want you to just continue talking a little bit more about your time in the service.
Well, when I took the train to Fort Lewis, Washington, then I caught a plane and went over to Japan. I had 6 weeks of basic training. No, just enough to learn how to salute, just enough to know what an officer and his badges look like. And after that, we didn't have any combat training. They called it combat training, but to me, none. I was in Japan in June, about 2 weeks before the Korean War started. And I was 17, and the Korean War started. And they said, well, you're going to Korea to do a police action. And I could not understand what a police action was. So I said to my platoon sergeant, Jerry Morgan, I said, what's a police action? Oh, he said, we'll crack a few heads. We'll be home in a couple weeks. I said, oh, well, let's go get it over with. bullets start flying. And you see a lot of your friends get killed, and you become very hard and very callous. And I came, then I was captured by the Chinese. And I spent, this was in November, and I spent 33 months in prison camp with the Chinese. The first year, 50 to 51, was devastating. The average nighttime temperature was 50 to 55 below zero. And we got captured with all summer clothes. In the service, being black, you got the last. Everybody else got their boots and their winters, this, and we didn't. But you don't know this, see, because you're up here and they're feeding in. Well, after being in prison camp for 33 months and the Chinese trying to teach us communism, and that's the greatest thing in the world, they kept saying, your people would enjoy it because they're free. And I said, freedom is be able to come and go as you please. I said, can the people in China do this? Oh, yes. I said, no, they can't. Just like the North Korean people can't go south. They said, don't get me. I had a good friend, Clarence Adams. We slept head to toe of each other in the barracks on the floor, straw mats. He believed in communism, I'm sure. And that's his belief. I don't take a man's belief away from him. And he used to go up every night to the Chinese and he'd come back. And after about a month and a half, he came back and he said, Fletch, you're irritating him. You're not going along with the program. He said, remember one thing, they've got the gun. So why don't you shut your mouth? I said, thanks, Clarence. And then on in, I never had any. They asked me, what is your opinion? I said, I don't know. You don't have it? No, I don't. And from that point on, we got along real well. The one thing, they were smart people. Everybody thinks they're dumb, but they're not dumb. But they did. They said, we're going to allow you to write letters home. This is after almost a year. And we'll give you the paper and pencils and everything you need. So I'm sitting here wondering, I said, why are they letting us write home? So I wrote my letter like I was coming out of the backwoods. T-E-H. Was A-W-S. These other guys, oh boy, they're right. So they knew they had education. And those were the suckers they went after. They said, leave him alone, he's crazy. He can't, he don't know anything. So I never was bothered with him. I never was bothered with him. And that's why, I guess, where I was very fortunate. I was able to outthink him at that point. Oh, they'd bring it everybody once a month. Oh, you could write a letter home to your mother, and I'd do the same thing. And none of those letters really left the prison camp. Not one of them. My mother had 53, I wrote two letters home that I have. They're out at the museum out there at the North Campus that I wrote home. There's probably more than that, but I know of three. And she had those when I came home. But no, they weren't about to let the educated ones get away.
Well, I certainly want to thank you for your service for our country.
Well, thank you.
I certainly want to thank you. And I need to say, too, if you ever, as we're doing this, you need to take a break. Just say you need to take a break.
No, I'm fine.
You're fine, okay. Anything else you want to add to that time?
Well, you know, people ask me, if you had to do it over again, would you do it over again? I've met enough South Koreans, and I've been back to South Korea twice. The government, Korean government paid for my trip there. I had to just pay for the airplane for my wife. So we both went twice. I was shocked when I got to that country in 2000s when I went back the first time, and I was literally shocked. I did not know that country. Modern homes, inside plumbing, everything was outside. Thatch roofs, mud houses, no, don't see one, you don't see one. And I looked around and I said, where am I? And my wife said, what's wrong? I said, there's no mud houses, there's no thatch roofs. And we went to the museum, their World Museum, which is fantastic. And when you walk in, there's a mud house with a thatch roof. And there's a big sign, this is what it was. Then we went back in 5 years later. We went back. I told them I didn't want to, and they insisted. They also called me, want me to go back a third time, and I told them no. But each time was a different venture. Each time was stirred up some real bad memories of guys I knew very well. I can't call their names today. I guess that's part of the healing process. But they were like brothers to me. That we buried, we couldn't bury him. At 50 below zero, the ground was like this concrete floor. We tried and tried and tried, and finally we just laid him on the banks of the Yalu River, covered him over with snow, and when the spring flood came, they washed down. But we tried, and you couldn't do a thing. You couldn't even scratch that much of the ground. And Johnny said, leave him, we'll bury him later. So we left him. That is one of probably the worst things is that I can remember that they tried to get us to leave him, and it was very hard. The other thing was that the Red Cross, the Romanian Red Cross, 52, They're communists, so they allowed them to come through and check the camp. Oh, man, they gave us these quilts to go on our bunks and new uniforms, new tennis shoes. So they came through and they allowed because they were communists, allowed them to kind of go individually. One of the guys had a list of all the POWs in that camp and all the POWs who had died. And this one guy from Romania spoke English, and he said, is there anyone here that has messages to take back? This guy says, yeah, I've got a list of POWs. He said, that good. So he took the list, and he turned it into the American Embassy in Romania. And 52, that's when my mother got a telegram from the War Department saying, "We think your son is a prisoner of war, but we can't prove it." And she was a little elated, but not to the fullest. She was, she didn't really believe it until I came home. First time she saw me, she gave me the biggest hug and kiss, and she looked, stepped back and she said, "Son, you're not this person, same person that left here." I said, "Yes, I am." She says, "No, you're not." And I truly didn't understand her. I figured, well, I didn't change, but I had. I'd become very hard, very callous, very little feelings for people. Somebody would say, "Oh, you know, so-and-so got hurt." I said, "Well, he shouldn't have been doing that. It's not my fault." And keep on walking. War does that to you. And that's one of the things you have to go through in post-traumatic stress. And I don't know how my wife stayed with me so long, because I tried to get her to leave. I had post-traumatic stress so bad at times. I'd get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and just go. And she'd say, "What time did you get up?" I said, "I don't know. It was daylight almost." And it wasn't. It was dark. "Where'd you go?" I said, "Down to the river, try to catch some fish." You know, I didn't do anything. I just had to be moving. I just had to be moving. And then in 2000, I'll never forget it. "You know what?" she said, "Fletch." I said, "No, I don't." She said, we should go see about these post-traumatic stress classes." I said, "If you got post-traumatic stress, go and do it, because I don't." I still had those urges. And sometimes I'd have the urge to want to hurt somebody, but I would never hurt my family. No, no, no. And I just get them, and you know, they're hard to get rid of. And finally, psychologist there at the VA was talking with me, and he said, "Come on with me, Fletch." And he took me down, and I talked to another psychologist, and then I ended up with Dr. Carnahan. And she was wonderful. At first, said, "I'm not going to like her." Yeah, said, "She don't know what's going on."
You decide that in advance that you weren't going to like her.
Yeah. So we talked, and she said, "Can you come back next week?" And I said, "Come back for what? Sit here and talk to you?" I said, "No." "Well, come back and talk. I'll look for you now." Gave me the time and everything. So I went back. And we got a little bit more serious. And she says, "Let me ask you a question. When's the last time you ever told your wife you loved her?" I said, "I told her that when I married her, and that's a good enough for me." She said, "What?" I said, "Why do you women have to always have men to tell them they love them? We do things to show you we love you." "Yeah, but we still like to hear it." I said, "Forget it." She said, "Your assignment is going to be go home and tell your wife you love her." I said, "Not living." I didn't for about 3 weeks. I was going every once a week to see her. I said, "I just can't do that." She said, "Oh, you're scared to let your guard down, aren't you?" So finally I did, and I came back, and she says, "Oh, you did, huh? Well, you feel better too, don't you?" I said, "Yeah." But I'd finally let the shield down that I had built up so long. And then I think the communication between my wife and I changed. I mean, we've always had good communication, but it's been, "Your job is to do this, my job is to do that. Don't bring me your problems. You handle your job. I will handle mine." And when we had a problem with the kids, then it's our problem. And then we both have to work on that. It never was, you take care of the kids. No. No, when they were tiny, I'd bundle them up and take them and go. She was working two nights a week. And I would go with them until she let her get some rest.
Well, you could. I said, nah, just go out to bed. She said, I'd take him and sneak out and be gone. But, you know, she brought me right out of it, you know, to the point that I kind of felt guilty, you know, that all these years, my wife and I have been married for 54 years.
It's wonderful.
In all these years, I was not able to verbally say this because of this shield that I had built. Post-traumatic stress is wicked. I'll tell anybody. Some people get over it, some can't. You always will have it. There are certain triggers. I can't watch certain movies, and especially movies of the military type.
Right. Mm-hmm.
My grandson says, Dad, let's go to a movie. I'll pay. I said, okay. And we went and saw this movie, We Are Soldiers. I came home, I was in a twizzy, and he knew it. He knew it during the movie. And it really got to me, because it was so close to being true. That was the most accurate movie I've ever seen of being true. And I said, oh, he said, was combat like that? I said, yes, it was.
And tell me the name of that movie again.
We Were Soldiers.
We Were Soldiers, okay.
Very good movie.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you start to talk about was family, and that moves us right into the next section. But before we go to that section, I want to ask you about, were there other African-Americans that were prisoners of war with you, or were you the only one?
I think this was the largest group of African-American POWs that... there were approximately 500 or 600.
Oh, wow, okay.
But you got to remember, the 24th Infantry Regiment was all African Americans. The artillery was all, 367 was all African Americans. Our Signal Corps was all African Americans. And when the Chinese let us come into the gauntlet, that's what we called it. And they circled each individual unit so you couldn't tie up, so you got strength. Oh, they knew what to do, please believe me. And we, so there was, we first encountered them, we fought 5 days with them, and out of 250, 139 of us surrendered. And 39 of us came back alive. And you can count other units that were, you'd fight as long as you had ammo, and then you run out and you have no objective but to surrender. So yes, there was, I would say totally, in other prison camps, I would put it about 800 African Americans.
Okay.
Yeah, all total.
Yeah. And it's good you're sharing that, because I'm, like myself, a lot of people probably don't even know that. Now, so you started talking about coming back and family life, and so you've already talked some about that, but one of the questions here is for you to tell a little bit about your married and family life, about your spouse, you've gotten into that a little bit, how you met, even in terms of when you were dating, engaged, and married. You said you've been married 54 years, so
yep.
Congratulations.
Well, that's not very hard to do.
It's not?
No,
okay.
I got married right after I got out of service, which was a big mistake.
Okay.
I tell anybody, before you get married, you got to know who you are. And I didn't know who I was. All my buddies were married, and I said, oh, that's the thing to do. They seem to be very happy. So I got married, and after couple years, I said, you know, this is not for me. I still had that individual attitude. If I wanted to go do something, I went and did it. And so, my ex-wife would say, where have you been? I said, oh, wait a minute. Are you a police officer? So why are you questioning me? Well, you didn't. I said, oh, don't ever question me again, please. Well, that didn't set too well, so we fought a lot. Not physically, but verbally we fought a lot. Finally, I told her, I said, what are you leaving? I said, I've had enough.
I said, either you leave or I'm leaving, and you can have the house as far as I'm concerned. I had bought the house in Ann Arbor. And I said, you can have it, because I can always buy me another house. Nope, I'm gone. So one day I came home, and she was gone. And first I was kind of really upset about it, but then as things went on, I felt much better. She filed for divorce right away in Pennsylvania and got a 90-day divorce. I had met my wife. I used to play semi-professional softball. And we were playing for the championship game, and she was dating a friend of mine. And I'd ask him about going to the game, if he wanted to go. It's the final game, a championship. And he said, yeah. He said, can I bring a friend of mine? I said, sure, you can bring two or three if you want. So he said, okay. So he brought her in to the house, because I was going to drive over. And I looked at her, I said, boy, you're the prettiest girl I've seen in a long time. I said, I'm going to marry you. Oh, no, no, no. I said, okay, you'll see. Well, I lost track of her. You know, I was single then, I got divorced. And she tickled me. Asked Ernie, I said, Ernie, I said, that Lady Carol, you still got her phone number? And he said, somewhere. And I said, give it to me. So he did, and I called her one day, and she said, well, you're married, aren't you? I said, no, I'm divorced now. I said, no. I said, would you like to go out to dinner or to a movie? Yeah. I said, okay. They had broken up. So we went to dinner and a movie, and then it kept to be just her and I. And so we dated about 3 months, 4 months, and I said, let's get married. She said, no, no, you got too many girlfriends. And she said, every time I'd at your house, the phone just ring off that. I said, I'm just, they're just friends. No, 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 they're women. So I said, okay, forget it. I said, because, you know, I can find somebody to marry. That's no problem with me. So about 2 days later, she was at the house, and she said, are you sure you want to get married? I said, yeah. But if you don't worry about it. She said, yeah, it's a good idea. So I said, she said, well, you want a big wedding, a small wedding, or what? She said, well, I'd like maybe 25 people or so. I said, fine. I said, you go ahead and plan it, and I'll take care of it. She said, no, my dad will. I said, hold, let's get something straight. You marry me. Your dad don't take care of none of our bills. Remember that. If we can't do it, we don't buy it. We do it together. Oh, but Dad's going to be upset. I said, I don't care if your dad's upset. I said, he don't come in and take over my place. Ah, okay. So we dated in about, this was April, May, and June. She said, I don't want a big wedding. Let's go to the minister and get married. And I said, fine. I said, save a lot of money. So that's what we did, and went to the Presbyterian Church minister and got married, and that's been, like I say, it's coming up on 54 years in July.
July what?
July 2nd.
July 2nd.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, you mentioned you went to the church, and you said you were Protestant.
Yep.
So I want to ask you a question about the role of the church then and the role of the church now in terms of in the community. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, my parents were mostly Methodists or Baptists. When I was a kid, we went to church for almost a full day. And I used to say to myself, when I get grown, I'm not coming back here. I said, I don't care for this long sitting in church listening to the same thing. I said, it's too much for me. So as soon as I was able to make decisions, sound decisions on my own, I told my mother, I'm not going back to church. She said, why? I said, too long. Can't take it. Everybody else is outside playing. I can hear them, and I'm sitting in here listening to preacher preach. Don't make sense to me. Now I go to church. It's 1 hour, which is just enough for me. And it's Presbyterian, and it's really not the preaching. It's what they're saying. And when you go to a Baptist or Methodist church, you get the really hell and damnation preaching. And Presbyterian is smooth. And once in a while, they'll bring in a gospel out of Detroit, boy, and the people in the audience just stand up. Oh, they just love it. And then they get their choir, and I said, see, the choir's dead. I said, they sing these songs, but they don't have any life to them. And that's the big difference to me.
So let me ask you this. So, and that was good in terms of your personal experience. In terms of the role of the church in the community, did you see a role then versus now, a different role now of the church getting out into the community?
I did not see a role in the church then. I did not see them helping other people in any way when I was young because I wasn't interested in it, I'll be honest with you. And after I came over to service, I did not go to church because my feeling was that God had punished me enough and I couldn't understand why. You know, here I was just 17 years old and I had to freeze and go through the tortures of being in prison camp and lice eating me up and why? You know, but I never looked at the trials and the tribulations. I never looked at them. It was me. And then about 3 years before I met my wife, I started going to the Presbyterian church with a friend of mine. And because the services were 1 hour, I enjoyed them. And I kept going. And my wife was a Presbyterian member too at the time, which was surprising. And she was going to the same church. But you know, you don't see somebody if you don't look for them.
It's true. So, you know, you talked about going into the service at 17, and now we're going to move into work. So once you came out of the service, what was your main field of employment? And how did you first get started with this job?
Well, my main thing of employment was the 52 weeks I had coming. 52 weeks at $52. It was 26 weeks when you added it up. I did nothing when I first came out because I just could not see direction. I had post-traumatic stress. I was confused. I re-enlisted back in the service, and then I backed out of that. I didn't know what to do. I just didn't know what to do. I didn't have any guidance of any sort, but I knew I had to do something. And eventually, a year after I was home, I slept in my car, and these people talking about, they sleep in it. I know what they go through. I did it all winter. I had a house I could go to and get into bed. Because something just kept me. It wasn't pride. It was post-traumatic stress now that I look back at it. And I slept in my car, leave it running for a while, turn it off, and wrap up in a blanket and sleep. But it took me a good year before I said, I gotta go to work, because my unemployment had ran out. I didn't have anything coming in, and I went to work for the Veterans Administration. This was 55, and I worked there until 65. And I left the VA shortly after my second child was born. I wasn't making enough money. And I told my wife, well, my wife was a nurse, and she said, well, I'll go back to work full-time rather than, I know you won't. Because I was, I guess, a pride thing with me. I was attacking my masculinity that I was not capable of providing. And so she didn't go back. She stayed part-time. And we'd always said, I said, if we're going to have kids, somebody's going to be at home for them. Because if school calls, somebody needs to go to school and see what the hell's going on. Not waiting until tomorrow, now. Because tomorrow they've forgotten what they did. Unless it's horrible. I don't think our kids will do anything horrible, but they'll do a lot of mischievous things. So she stayed home until all the kids were in school full time. And then she went back to work midnight. So when she came in the morning, I'd go to work. I left the VA and went to work for Sears and Roebuck. And I worked about 7 years, 6 years for Sears and Roebuck. And they were moving everything down to Livonia. I was in the service department. They also sent me to Chicago for see if I was could be trained to become a store manager. And I passed all their tests. And they said, Bob, we'd like to send you. I said, well, I've got to think about this. I got a family, a growing family, and I just can't say pull up roots and go. It's simple if you're money hungry, but I'm not. So Carol and I talked about it, and she said, well, you can do it. I'll be behind you. I said, no, it's not. It's the kids. What will they do? Will they go to an area to where the kids don't like them? Now we got a fight on our hands. I said, so it's more than that. Yeah, but this is your opportunity. And I said, no, life is an opportunity itself. Don't give me that. So we talked it over and talked it over, and she still ended up saying, it's your choice. And after 2 weeks, I told the store manager, Mr. Jones, here in Ann Arbor, I said, I'm sorry, Mr. Jones, I can't accept this. And he said, why? I said, because of my family. I said, I can't unroot my family and move them here. There's no guarantee I'll be at this store for over a year, and then uproot them and move them over here. I said, they won't have any friends. They're all screwed up in their heads. And to me, kids have to have friends. That's part of their maturing. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, but you, I said, oh, I don't money any hell, I can make money. I said, but I can't keep my kids happy and keep them maturing normally. Okay, Bob. And so I didn't take it, and my wife was glad because we're in Ann Arbor, they can get a very good rounded education. And they can come home and talk to your parents about what's going on. As assistant store manager, you're supposed to be working 10, 12 hours a day. You come home, you're tired, you don't really want to hear it. And, you know, and it's not fair, as far as I'm concerned. It's just not fair. So I didn't take the job. I became assistant service manager for Sears. I did all incoming merchandise. And that was a good job, and I got paid extra for it. Good, I got a good pay for it, really. But I just had that bug to try it for myself, and I went into a bicycle sewing machine repair shop.
Sewing machine, did you say?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Because I'd been trained on sewing machines on Stadium Boulevard. And did quite well for about 12 years. And then the recession hit and things kind of went. Then I had a heart attack and had to go in the hospital. And then I got out and went back into the bike business and things, I just didn't transfer over. I started about 6 months later, my blood pressure was back up and
pressure of owning your own business, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And with an A personality. 3-4 hours sleep, and then you're back at it, figuring out, why didn't I do this much this year compared to last year? I didn't sell many bikes. Why? You know, you're it's just killing you. I didn't sell sewing machines. I did mostly repairs on them. And so people would bring them in, and I would fix them. I don't know if I could do it today, but I used to be able to do it. But no, we did all right. So I sold the business, got out of it, had another heart attack, and the doctor said to the wife, he's going to kill himself. And that, well, she told me I was getting out of it or getting divorced. And the kids were not grown yet, and I looked at her. I said, no, I ain't getting divorced. Oh, yeah. She said, I'm not going to see you kill yourself. That business goes or we go. Oh, God. Taking one vacation in 7 years. <Don't have time. laughs> I said, how much money do you need to go on vacation? No, we're going. I said, oh, no, I don't have time to go on vacation. Oh, yes. I ended up going on vacation.
I was going to ask that. That was going to be my next question.
No, I ended up going. She put the kids on me. Every day, Dad, we're going on vacation. When are we leaving? I said, your mother's going to take you. No, Dad, we want you to come. I told her, dang on your time. And all of them. So I just had to take off for them. You know, I've always felt the kids were what really, in many times, kept us together, especially times I was exploding. And you know, my daughters, both of them, my two oldest daughters, said, oh, Dad, we understood. I said, I'm glad you did, because I didn't. I would explode, literally explode, then walk out the house and come back in and say, hey, let's go to Dairy Queen. But they say they understood. My son and I, my oldest son, he and I had a problem. I didn't know how to handle him. I didn't know how to talk to him, because I never had a father to talk to. And I'd be doing something, and he'd come in, and he'd have a problem, like with his motorcycle. He'd go out in the back 10 acres and ride it and come in. He'd say, Dad, I say, what? He said, it's cutting out. I said, oh, it is. I said, you know what's wrong with it? No. When I'm coming along, not normally it doesn't. I said, yeah. I said, what do you think it is then? He said, I don't know. I said, what do you think you should be looking for? I don't know. I said, until you can give me a better answer than that, I'm not going to help you. Oh, he exploded. Went in the house, told his mother, Dad won't even help me. Dad won't help me. She comes out. What is wrong with Joe? I said, I have no idea. Well, he said, you won't talk to him. I said, yes, I've talked to him. He won't help him. I said, if I do the job, then he won't know what to do. I want him to diagnose this. If he's wrong, I'll tell him he's wrong, Carol. So don't you come out here telling me my business. So you go on back in the house. I said, and I mean now, before I say something you don't like. She'd go on back in the house, and he'd come out. Dad, can you help me? I said, sure, I can help you, but you got to tell me something, son. You've told me a little, but you have to diagnose it and tell me, and I'll tell you real quick, you know, you're wrong. And so he guessed at a few things. I said, no. I said, it's your ignition breaking down. And so I told him, start it up, take the wire loose and pull it away, and you should be able to pull it about that far away and still have an arc, and it would stop. Then it would start, and it would stop. Oh, so he went up to the motorcycle place and got points and condensers. And he didn't know how to put them in, and I helped him do that. Stopped my work. Went out to the field. Oh, it was great. Oh, thank you, Dad. Oh, you're welcome. But, you know, other than that, we had a hard time with him. He got into drugs quite heavy. That was some trying times. And he ended up in out here at the boys' reformatory, or boys' jail. And the judge says, okay, I'm going to send him home with you. I said, no, you're not. The judge said, huh? I said, no, sir, you're not sending him home with me. Now, do you understand that? He said, yeah, why not? I said, because he's got a drug problem, and nobody's looking at it. And he needs help. Oh, okay, he said. Well, the judge knew of a place up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul, drug place. And so we took him up there, and he was court-ordered up there.
So did he get the help, and how is he now?
Oh, shoot, he knew how to fake those people out. He was very intelligent, highly intelligent, highly intelligent. When he was in sixth grade, he was reading at 12th grade level. He had reading all of the, I can't even remember the name of the movies that were out, were the space movies. He had read every one of those books. I said, how long did it take you, Joe? Oh, he said, about a day and a half. Mm-hmm. Eight chapters, eight books.
Now that leads me back to the retirement. You mentioned, you talked about the children, and you talked about your heart attacks. And so the question here is, how did your life change when you and or your spouse retired and all the children left home?
Well, my life changed really nice. I felt it was really nice to have the house quiet and none of them around bugging me. And, well, we raised our grandson, too. We had one grandson we raised from the time he was that high and up until he was grown and went to college. Jerome, he used to ask us, Dad, I'd say, what? How am I going to go to college? I don't have any money. I said, well, don't worry about it. So your grandmother's going to take care of it. I said, well, I don't eat for the next year. She's going to see that you go to college, young man.
Even she doesn't feed you, huh?
That's right. And so she did. She had set the money aside as time went on. She's always been the banker. I've been the spender. And Jerome finished college up at, which one did he go to? Up above Grand Rapids. Anyway, he enjoyed.
Ferris. Was it Ferris?
No, the other one. Hmm. There's another one up there.
Okay.
But he went there and he enjoyed himself. And
okay.
Graduated.
He did finish?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Wonderful. Like I told him, you don't quit.
Okay.
No. That's a no-no.
So this section was about work, retirement, and, you know, the children leaving home. But I want to back up for a second because I want to ask you the question about employment opportunities for minorities, African Americans, then versus now. I think you hit on it a little bit earlier, but add a little bit more to that.
Well, today, the opportunity for African Americans today to move up is great as long as you've got the education. If you want to stay with McDonald's or Burger King or some of those, that's where you're going to be if you don't have the education. Become a custodian. And a lot of places now require at least a high school education to become a custodian. So opportunities, when I was a young man, that's all you could become. We used to call them janitors. And you didn't have any opportunities to really, or you went into the teaching profession, but you had an education. And when I was in school, I went to Harriet Street School, called Perry Street School now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, probably may not remember it as Harriet Street School, but that's what it was. Dominantly African Americans. We had about 10 white families that went there. And then they redistricted everything, which I knew nothing about redistricting as a young person. And then it became mostly dominantly black. But we had teachers, mixed teachers. We had black and white teachers. Now, I'll tell you one thing, the black teachers were tough on you. They wouldn't take no crap off you. Oh, no. And it was good. That's what I needed. I'm just speaking for me. I can't speak for all of them. Mm-hmm. I got my hands hit with that old triangular ruler. Ooh, boy, I just quiver. Now, she says, I'm going to call you mother. Oh, don't do that, please. Because I knew what mother would do when I walked in that house. Oh, you're running to school now, huh? No, ma'am. But no, that was the biggest difference
in terms of employment opportunities.
The employment opportunity was nil, really, for African Americans, unless they had an education.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like right now, the VA in Ann Arbor is probably one of the most prejudiced places that a person of color would like to be hired into.
Right, this very day.
This very day. I know of three people who have college education applied for it, and they've got 18, 19 years with the VA. And according to the VA, you hire first within before you move to the outside. They've applied for physicians that start out at about 80,000. They hire some white person from the outside. VA is very prejudiced, and I've talked to people over there. And nothing. It won't change.
So there are issues then, and it continues to be issues now, is what you're saying, in certain areas.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Big issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to move us into the historical social events, which is part five and the final part for the interview. Tell me how it has been for you to live in this community.
Well, it's been very easy for me to live. I've always had a job. I bought a house here. Then I bought a second house here. Then I bought a third house here. And so my living here has never been a problem for me. And it has been a problem for my kids as long as they could go to Ann Arbor High School. If you buy a house where that other school is, we're not going to live with you. I said, boy, that'd be great. But no, Ann Arbor has never been a hard city for me to live in. I know a lot of people here, and a lot of people know me. Even before they realized that I was a veteran of Korea. And it hasn't been hard, really, at all. I think the one thing you haven't covered was my wife.
Okay, I sort of asked a little bit, but let's go back and talk about her.
My wife is Caucasian.
Okay.
She had a degree in nursing, 5-year nursing degree at the University of Michigan. And she was working part-time, and they got a new director in, and she said, well, all the part-time people had to go. So she let them go, and she found out she had no nurses. So she tried calling them back, and my wife said, no, I'm not coming back. My wife went to work for the state, and what she was doing, she had one of the jobs of testing doctors and pharmacists for drugs.
Testing the doctors and?
Pharmacists.
Okay.
Randomly, they had to go in. They never knew, but they had to go with the person. Mm-hmm. Urinate in a little jug, and then that was sent to them. And then they tested it. Then the state decided, oh, that's too much money. We can't afford under our good governor. So he cut out all that program. So she said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do right now. She got a nice severance package. And I said, well, just take your time. Stay home. And she did for about a week, and then she went over to the VA and put in her application.
A week wasn't very long.
I'm sorry. She went to Byer in Ipsy.
Okay.
No, a week ain't not long. That's too long for her. She went to Byer, and after about 10 or 15 years with Byer, they needed a new director of nursing there, and she applied for it, and she ended up taking, she ended up as one of the finalists. Only difference, she didn't get the job, she just had a degree, RN degree. So she came home one day and she said, I'm going back to school. And I said, fine. So she went back to school and got her master's. And we have a home up in northern Michigan, up by Alpena, year-round home. We were going up there and she says, what do you think if I go back and get my PhD? I never said a word. I'm driving along and she said, did you hear me? I said, yes, I heard you, and I think you're crazy. I said, you're talking 8 to 10 years. I said, heck, I'll be retired by then. Yeah, but what's that got to do with me? I said, do it then. So she went back to 4 years, she got her PhD.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And worked full time.
And had a husband to look after, too. Huh?
Well, and some kids, and some kids. But she has enjoyed herself, and she then left Byers closed. And she didn't do anything for, she can't stay empty she, for a couple weeks. And then she said, well, I'm going to go to the VA and put in my application. And she did. And she was working in research, and she worked there, and then there were two of them, and they said, well, they didn't have enough money to support the two positions. They only had enough money to support one. And since Mrs. Fletcher's been here the longest, she said, what if I go to part-time 3 days a week? Would that be enough money? And they said, yeah. She said, okay, I'll work 3 days a week. And the other person was a young person. They could work full time.
Right.
So that's what she does. She works Monday through Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Then I have to put up with the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Sounds like you're pretty proud of her, though.
Oh, I am very proud of her.
I can tell. I have a couple more questions, and we'll be wrapping it up.
Okay.
When thinking back over your entire life, what are you most proud of?
There's a couple of things I'm most proud of. One is my wife. The intelligence that she had to stick with me and to save everything she could save and not spend. And she was very patient, very lovable. Second thing was that I got a call from Jesse Brown, who's Secretary of Veteran Affairs back in the late 80s. And he said, Mr. Fletcher, we'd like for Mr. Fletcher to be on the advisory board for former prisoners of war here in Washington. We meet twice a year. And she said, well, he isn't here. And I hate to tell you, yes. And he'll hit the ceiling. So when he comes home, he should be home in about a half hour. So I was home and the phone rang and his secretary or whoever it was said, we'd like for you to be on the advisory board, Mr. Fletcher. I said, yeah, what's the advisory board? We meet twice a year. And I said, no, I don't want to be bothered. Thank you very much, and hung up. And I said, I've got to go something, do so-and-so. She said, okay. So they called back and they said, we want him to be on. She said, fine, he'll be there. Well, I ended up putting 21 years on the advisory board.
That's wonderful.
I retired, I resigned this past May. And they want, they've been postponing the meeting since August to give out the plaques and stuff. And so they finally said it'll be July this year. So I thought, I'll be bothered. I said, this is the 10th time they've postponed it, and I just don't want to be bothered. I'm fed up. So she sent him a nice email saying, I'm sorry, we have other obligations. I said, why didn't you tell him the truth? You don't do that. But no, I've had, it's been a joyful 54 years, mainly because of her. She takes very good care of me, makes sure I take my medicine. If I don't, she's right there.
That's wonderful.
And, you know, it's kept me alive.
Okay, that's great. So, advice would you give to the younger generation now?
What advice would I give to the younger generation? I used to speak to some of the pioneer students, one of the history classes. And when I finished, I would say this. The first thing you say is you don't have enough money to go to college or any money. But you never said you could go into service and earn enough money to go to college. You're doing something for this country. You're earning money to go to college. It's called work, but it pays off in the end. And as a young person, work has never killed a young person yet. I've had three or four of the African-American students come back and call me, Mr. Fletcher, you don't remember me, but you were in my class and spoke. I went into service and put in 3 years, and now I got enough money to go to college. And I said, it works, don't it? And he said, yes. I want to thank you. And I said, well, thank you very much for your service. But that's the thing I usually end up telling kids that tell me I can't go to college. So what are you taught? Yes, you can. It's up to you. Sacrifice 6 years or whatever it takes to get that nest egg. But that's the only thing I tell them myself personally. Military is a way of serving your country. And they need young people to serve this country because this is their country. You know, and pretty soon you and I or none of the old people will be here. It'll be theirs. What are they going to do with it? You've got to know what this country has to offer to you and what you offer to this country. If you don't know those two things, you're in a big, big bind. And that the kids who drop out of school, that's the bind they're in. They're just wandering. They just don't know what to do. You see them every day on the blocks. You see them on the corners. They don't know what to do. The ones that are prosperous, they're going to community college. I went to community college. Place was almost empty. You can't even find a parking place out there anymore. It's so full.
It's true.
Wow! My grandson, he started working with me in my shop at home. And he said, Grandpa, I'd like to be a carpenter. I said, it's a good trade. I said, but probably the only way you're going to become a carpenter is go out to community college and take their course, because this learning it by rote and by ear is no more good. You got to have the certificate to get a good job. Well, he went out there and he forgot he didn't pay his last time when he dropped out. It was still on the books. So he come home and he wouldn't say nothing. And I said, well, what happened out of community college, boy? Well, they told me until my bill was paid. I said, what bill? $400 or something. I can't remember the figure. I said, yeah, you've thrown that away so many times you don't even know what to do with it, haven't you? Well, I said, oh, don't. You know, your grandfather don't like excuses. Because I call that BS. So tell me the facts. He did, and I went in the house and I talked to his grandmother. He talked to his grandmother. And I said, okay, I'll loan you the $400. And so we gave him the money, and he went over and paid it. Now, to get into class, he needs $1,200.
Went up a little bit, huh?
Oh, yeah, but he don't have no money. So I said, Keenan, you know, you're getting to be an expensive tab. I said, you go talk to your grandmother, see what she thinks. She kind of read him the riot act, and So we lent him the $1,200 to go to school. I told Carol, I said, where's our own kids? He's just a grandson, but dang, you thought he lived here on 24 hours a day. You ask about empty house. I've never had an empty house.
Somebody's always been in and out.
Well, my grandson, he grew up and he started his business. He lived there for till he was 32, something like that. Then he moved out. Then my oldest, next to the oldest daughter, got divorced. She moves back with her son, and she's still there, which is great. You know, I told my kids, I love them dearly. You can stay, but you do what you're supposed to do. Right. That's the only thing I say. If your mother says you're going to do the dishes every day, you do them. If you don't want to do them, pack your bags and go. That's the only way I can put it to you.
It's interesting because you often hear parents say, you know, people are coming and going. And so I hear that a lot. So
yeah.
It's good they have some place to go home to.
It is. And yeah. I've always told them, home is where you should be.
Right, right.
Then you can think it over, talk to us, and see what we can work out.
Right. So what I'm going to do now is give you a chance for any final thoughts that you want to leave us with.
Well, I would say my final thought is that I've enjoyed this. I've enjoyed the questions. I would like to speak briefly of the advisory board. When I went on the advisory board in Washington, D.C., I was the only African-American. I was the first African-American on it. And they were all officers, colonels, generals, and I was an enlisted man. And then Dick McCauley came on, and he was an enlisted man. Sergeant was the highest rank. I was a PFC. And they treated us like they wanted to walk on us. 70% of the ideas they got from us. 60% of the POW treatment they got from us and the doctors. And Dr. McNish, we did a survey after they gave seminars for VA people and post-traumatic stress and everything else. And I went to three, I spoke at three of them about my post-traumatic stress. And I found that they were the best things that really we did in educating nurses and doctors. See, this VA hospital knows nothing about POWs. POWs have first priority at all VA hospitals. And a good example was I went down to Detroit, didn't say a word for a sleep study. Golly, looked up my record. Oh, he said, you're a former POW. He said, okay, you come on right now. Got done, took me over to this other doctor, and he says, oh, you're a POW. Wait a minute. Well, let me get on this phone. He calls somebody, said, hey, let's expedite this thing right away. We got a POW here, and we can't be waiting around. Okay, he called him by name and hung up. He said, oh, yeah, we'll have everything taken care of before the week's out. You think that would happen at this hospital? No, 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 no. No, they don't even know what a POW is. I don't think they know what words mean. Really, I don't.
So you felt the advisory board gave you an opportunity to really share that with people on a national level?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And then we used to have people coming in from American Legion, VFW, and everywhere else to sit in on some of our seminars mm-hmm. or some of our sessions. I think the second greatest thing that ever happened to me, I was the first and only African-American to become commander of American ex-prisoners of war. All white, largest organization, the largest POW organization in the world.
Congratulations.
And my wife and five other ladies expedited that thing. Oh, they didn't want me. They and toward the end, they got very nasty, and toward the end, they
they were just too much. So I told them, couldn't quiet them down or nothing. I just walked out. Mm-hmm. I said, before I hurt somebody, mm-hmm. one lady ran up to me and she went to put, I said, don't put your touch me. Whatever you do, don't touch me. Mm-hmm. Please. Because when you touch me, that's a sign of war. Mm-hmm. She backed away. I said, thank you. Walked out, went upstairs, went to bed, slept good, got up. Had a dinner that night I went to. Introduced a couple people I wanted to get a plaques. And they knew about it. And they said, Fletch, we're so proud of you. How did you do it? I said, like nothing, I can do it for anybody. I said, as long as they don't touch me, I'm fine. They can call me anything they want to. But don't put your hands on me, because once you touch me, that's war. And I will try to hurt you bad. But those were probably my wife. She, when they wanted me to run, a group did. I told them no, because I didn't think I stood a chance being an African American in kicking people who were from the South. She got on the phone and made about 15 calls. She said, "We're behind you. You're gonna run." She's white. Mm-hmm. "You're gonna run." Mm-hmm. I said, "No." She said, "You're gonna run. Your name's already been submitted."
So how long did you hold the position?
It's a 1-year position.
Well, okay.
It's a 1-year position.
Yeah, that's great though. But you know, it takes you back to, when we talk about then and now, in terms of experiences, be it employment or education, in the military. Things have come up a long ways. But yeah. There's still more work to be done.
So, yes, there is. No, don't think that right. We're home free. No, yeah. No.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the work has got to be aimed at the African-American community mm-hmm. in their attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I'm not talking about get on your knees. No.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about learning how to talk.
Right.
Like my kid would come in with this street talk, and when he hit the door,
mm-hmm.
stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd look at me. I say, now turn around, go back out that door. And when you come in this house, you speak American English.
Mm-hmm.
That's what your mother and I speak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
But that was one thing that we insisted, that they speak very good English, mm-hmm. because if you speak good English, you can get a job. You don't need an education.
Right.
But if you can't speak, mm-hmm. nobody wants to hire you.
Right. Well, one of the things that you've done today is you've given us share a wealth of information, and not only for young people but for adults, and just sharing your story. We really, really appreciate that. So I just want to say that on behalf of the African American Cultural and Historical Museum of Washtenaw County, I want to thank you very much for doing this interview.
Well, thank you very much.
You.
I was proud to do it.
Yeah.